Matthew chapter 16. We are continuing our series through the Gospel of Matthew. This is message number 40 in that series, entitled The Son of the Living God. And we're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 16, beginning with verse 13 down to verse 28, so the rest of this chapter. And as we begin, I'm going to read verses 13 to 16. When Jesus came into the coasts of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" And they said, "Some say that thou art John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." He saith unto them, "But whom say ye that I am?" And Simon Peter answered and said, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." So chapter 16 opened with a confrontation between Jesus and certain officials from Jerusalem, these Sadducees and Pharisees. And they came to test Jesus by asking him for an apocalyptic sign from the heavens, such as those that were prophesied to accompany the coming of the Messiah and the day of the Lord. Of course, they didn't believe he was the promised Messiah, and they didn't believe that he could perform such a sign, even though they knew that he could perform many miracles, which he had. But this confrontation highlights Israel's rejection of Jesus of Nazareth as the Christ. And that sets up what we see in the rest of this chapter, because in the rest of chapter 16, Matthew gives us three different exchanges, or there's sort of part of a sequence between Jesus and his apostles, and Jesus gives revelation to them. Now, this is where Matthew records Peter's confession of Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the living God. And this is a turning point in Matthew. It's also a turning point in Mark. And it's also a turning point in Luke, in the account of the gospel of Jesus. Now, John, on the other hand, does not record this particular instance, but the other three all do. And it is that turning point in the other three gospels. Now, prior to this, and it's a, sort of a way that you could see it as maybe a midpoint. And if you think about what has happened in Matthew's gospel prior to this, Jesus has spoken of the kingdom being near. He has worked great public miracles as signs of the Messiah and the messianic kingdom offered to Israel. And after this, from this point forward, he is pointed more toward Jerusalem. He's begins speaking of his death and his resurrection to his apostles privately. And so this marks a discernible change in the focus of Jesus' ministry. And the clear note that comes out here in Matthew 16 is for Jesus and his apostles that suffering comes before glory. And as you look at each of these three instances at the end of chapter 16, you're going to notice that each of these three instances contain some reference to death. And it is thematic in everything that we're looking at here at the end of chapter 16. So we're going to look at each of these instances. So verses 13 to 20, where Jesus essentially asks the question, "Who am I?" Verses 21 to 23, where Jesus gives the first clear foretelling of his death. And verses 24 to 28, where Jesus speaks about coming in judgment and glory. So we're going to start with the first part, where Jesus asks, "Who am I?" Let's begin with verse number 13. When Jesus came into the coasts of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" Now, Caesarea Philippi was north of Galilee, north of Bethsaida. It was in part of the tribal inheritance of Dan. This would have been in the northernmost territory of Israel. This is also real close by neighboring Gentile regions. There was a large Gentile presence throughout Caesarea Philippi, so there was quite a mix that was there. And here Jesus went with his disciples, and he identified himself as the Son of Man. He says, "You know, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" He identifies himself as the Son of Man and essentially asks his 12 disciples who that the people said that he was. Now, the Son of Man, we have noticed it since it began to be used in Matthew. This is a messianic title, and it comes primarily from Daniel chapter 7 and verses 13 and 14. And the Son of Man there in Daniel's vision, in his prophecy, the Son of Man is a human figure who approaches the Ancient of Days on his throne in the heavens, and he receives dominion and glory and a kingdom. He defeats the kingdoms that are warring against Israel on the earth and establishes his kingdom on earth, where he will reign forever over the nations of the earth who will worship him. Now, this title, Son of Man, also refers to the Son of Adam, the Son of Adam who is crowned with glory and will rule over the kingdom of the earth where the first Adam failed. And we can read about that in Psalm 8. So Matthew uses this title, Son of Man, around about 30 times. And in the early part of Matthew's gospel, he uses it about 5 times and speaks mostly of the earthly ministry work of Jesus. And that comes in chapters 8 to 13. And then the rest of those occurrences are in the latter part of Matthew's gospel, 10 times in chapters 12 to 28. The title refers to his messianic sufferings directly, and another 15 times that title refers to his future coming in glory with judgment to establish his kingdom on the earth. And that begins in chapter 10 and occurs in from there to chapter 26 in Matthew. So this is the title that Jesus uses as he begins, and he asks this question, "Whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" Verse 14, "And they said, some say that thou art John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." So the apostles respond to this question essentially saying that the general population's opinions vary somewhat. Some assume that you are John the Baptist. In other words, John that has essentially been reincarnated, as was the fear of Herod when he heard of Jesus. Some say that you know, you're Elijah or Jeremiah or, you know, one of the other prophets. In other words, the general consensus, you might say, belief about Jesus was that he was a great prophet. He worked many miracles. He did things that had not been seen or heard of in Israel since the beginning. And so he certainly was a great prophet. Well, this answer actually, though I don't know that was necessarily the disciples' intention, they're just answering the question, what the general opinion was, but their answer actually highlights the unbelief of the people of Israel in the main. They thought him to be a prophet, but not the Son of God. They didn't think him to be the Messiah who was prophesied to come. He's a great teacher. He obviously has, you know, a great understanding of the Old Testament. He has a lot of power. He's done a lot of good. Look at all the people that have been healed and have been helped and benefited and have been fed, and he's done a lot of good things. And they may have believed all of that and had good thoughts generally about this Jesus of Nazareth, but they didn't actually believe that he was the Son of God. So he's highlighting their unbelief. And it's actually showing us, once again, drawing our attention to Israel's rejection of the king and his kingdom. And that's how this chapter started, with that confrontation with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Verse number 15, "He saith unto them, but whom say ye that I am?" So now the emphasis is on this question being directed to the apostles, to the 12. So that's the general consensus or general opinion about who Jesus of Nazareth is, but who do you say that I am? Verse 16. And Simon Peter answered and said, Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, Peter comes to the front here in terms of at least answering this question, and we've talked a little bit about how we've seen Peter sort of slowly emerge as a leader among the apostles, and we're going to see him being more prominent, especially in this latter half of Matthew's gospel among the 12. And he says that, Thou art the Christ. Now remember, the word for Christ, it's not a name. It is a title. Jesus is both Lord and Christ. Christ, the word, means anointed. That's the word that comes from the Greek. It means anointed or anointed one. And again, it is equivalent to the Hebrew word in the Old Testament from which we get the word Messiah. And so that's essentially what Peter said to Jesus. He said, You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. So Peter confesses that Jesus of Nazareth, the one born of Mary, the one raised by Joseph, the one who had younger brothers and sisters, at least stepbrothers and sisters or half-brothers, I'm not sure how you would calculate that, but he had these other siblings that were the children of Joseph and Mary after that Mary gave birth to Jesus, that he was the Holy Anointed One, whom God would send as prophesied by his prophets. That's what Peter is saying when he says, You are the Christ, you are the Messiah, you are the Anointed One. And that he was the Son of the living God. Now, this title or this reference to the living God is somewhat common. It occurs a number of times in the Old Testament, places like Deuteronomy 5:26, Psalm 42:2, and there's other references as well. And generally, this reference, the living God, identifies the true God and distinguishes him from false gods and dead idols. And that he is the Son of the living God. Now, describing Jesus as the Son of God, or identifying Jesus as the Son of God, is giving this exact identification. And really, what Peter is saying in total, you know, who do you say that I am? Peter says, well, you are the Christ, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. So he is showing that Jesus is clearly the prophesied figure who was to come. You can look at places like Psalm 2 that we studied, though it's been a few years ago that we studied Psalm 2. But you can look at places like Psalm 2 where actually both of these things come together. He is the anointed, the prophesied anointed one in Psalm 2 and verse 2. He is also the Son, God's Son, Psalm 2 verses 7 and 12. He is the King on Zion, Psalm 2 and verse 6. He's the inheritor and judge of the nations in Psalm 2 verses 8 and 9. So essentially what Peter is saying is that you are the one. You are the one who was promised. You are the one who was prophesied to come. And essentially it is a confession of deity that you're God in the flesh. Verse number 17. And Jesus answered and said unto him, Blessed art thou, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. So Peter was pronounced blessed here because it wasn't human wisdom or human endeavor that revealed this to Peter, but it was Jesus' Father in heaven who revealed it to him and the other disciples, of course, Judas being excepted. So there's a distinction here between those of Israel who rejected, which was the majority and certainly the certainly the vast majority of the leading and ruling class, and those who believed of Israel, that remnant, that small number, that fraction of the whole of Israel. And that difference between them was not measurable intelligence. The difference between them was not man hours of study that was put in. Again, you had many of those in that leading class and the teachers and the rulers of Israel who essentially, you know, their job, their vocation involved the study of the Torah and the rest of the Tanakh as well. So it's not a difference in intelligence. I mean, in fact, sometimes many of the disciples were looked down upon as being Galileans, uneducated and rough men that were fishermen and such. How could they have the learning and such the understanding that they had? Well, Jesus says that the difference, the distinction is here that this has been shown to you by my Father. And then in verse number 18, "And I say unto thee, that thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." Now, notice this little phrase that Jesus uses here when he says, "And I say also unto thee." We've talked about this a little bit as we've been going through Matthew. And this little formula that Jesus uses, he's giving some sort of new revelation when he says, "I say unto you." And again, if you go back to the Sermon on the Mount and the end of it there in Matthew chapter 7, this is Jesus speaking as a lawgiver, as one who has authority. He's not saying Moses said. He's not saying Elijah said or Jeremiah said or Daniel said. He's not even saying the word of the Lord came to me and said. He says, "I say unto you," and then he speaks of things, some of which these men had never heard about before. We saw that just like back in Matthew chapter 13. So Matthew doesn't use the word mystery here, but we did see that word used in Matthew chapter 13, where Jesus revealed to his apostles, to those 12 men, what had been kept hidden about the kingdom from the creation. And that's namely that the kingdom would not come with the coming of the Messiah, but rather would come with his return. In other words, there would be an intervening age between the first and second coming of Christ. And Paul wrote of this age between the comings of Christ and before the kingdom was established. He wrote of this age, and he spoke of that mystery in this age where Israel would be temporarily blinded and where they would be set aside until the fullness of the nations in this age, and then Israel will be saved as prophesied. Paul writes about this, Romans chapter 11, verse 25 and 26, and again referring to that mystery. It's the same time period, same relation to the kingdom. So Jesus gives this revelation to his apostles during this delay, if you will, of the kingdom. And he said two things in particular about this age. He said that he would build up his church, and that word ecclesia, his congregation, his assembly, on the rock of his identity, and that the gates of hell wouldn't overcome or prevent this building up that he had purposed to do. So in all four gospel accounts, we're talking Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all four gospel accounts, which comprise a pretty good bit, actually, of the New Testament. This word, ecclesia, only occurs twice. Only twice. And both times Jesus used it. He uses it here in chapter 16. He will use it again in chapter number 18, and that's it. It's the only two times Jesus ever said anything about it. The word itself literally means the called out. And it is the majority usage of the term that it was used to describe some sort of a gathered assembly, some sort of a congregation, and that could be the meeting of a city state with the citizens assembled for some sort of meeting. That could be sort of an unofficial, would be called ad hoc, where you had just sort of an assembly that came together over some common purpose, whatever that it was. But we also know that it's used much later in the New Testament, particularly beginning with Acts, to refer to those particular congregations of Jesus Christ that were started after his first one there in Jerusalem. So again, the word mystery is not used here, but Paul, in writing in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 32, did refer to the church that Jesus is talking about as a mystery. It wasn't revealed in the Old Testament. The apostles were not walking around, following Jesus around, scratching their heads and wondering, when is he going to start this church that we've been taught to expect and look for? They had no idea, no knowledge of it whatsoever until Jesus spoke these very words to them. So this is first revealed here by Jesus. And it's revealed as something that he would build in this intervening age before the kingdom comes. Clearly, the church and the kingdom are not the same thing. The church started with one, of course, there in Jerusalem, and soon became many, as we see in the book of Acts, for instance. But churches exist in this age because the kingdom is not here. Because Israel, the national witness of God, is temporarily blinded in this age and is set aside. So the churches that Jesus would build, that he begins to talk about here, will be those corporate witnesses of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, in this particular age. And then the second thing that he said about it was what he had purposed to do, that the gates of hell would not prevail against. Now, the word for hell here, Hades, in the Greek, and it refers not as specifically as we might think of in terms of hell with fire and brimstone and sulfur and all that sort of thing. It refers more specifically to the realm of the dead. Now, sometimes it certainly is used in association of what we think of more properly as hell, but it is equivalent to terms in the Old Testament, much like the term Sheol. Sheol is used to refer to the realm of the dead, and particularly to distinguish it from the land of the living. Sometimes it's just simply translated grave, or sometimes it might be simply referred to as death. Sometimes it's translated as hell. Now, so when you look at the use of this term coming forward from the Old Testament, this realm of the dead is a place that Job referred to, and he referred to going there as meaning the end of his work and his purposes in the land of the living. So that's Job chapter 17, verses 11 to 16. So in other words, there's a clear distinction to be in the land of the living and to go to the realm of the dead means to leave. You can't be in both, and you can't go back and forth. It means to be done. In fact, Hezekiah, you'll recall that Hezekiah was sick and was told that he was going to die, and he prays, and God adds 15 years to his life. And Hezekiah essentially lamented that he would go there to this realm of the dead, and his life would be cut short on the earth so that he wouldn't see promises fulfilled. So if you're following this as we're sort of moving through and thinking about this concept from the Old Testament, this reference to the realm of the dead, it's a place, if you think about it in Ecclesiastes, how Solomon told us to, you know, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, because there's no work, there's no device in the grave to where all men are going. So your life here, this present life, this mortal life, is over when you go to the realm of the dead. And so whatever your purposes were, whatever your plans were, whatever it was that you hoped to accomplish, that's all done. That's all over with. Whether you accomplished it or didn't accomplish it, it's all finished. That's it. And so that is the distinction that we see in this realm of the dead reference coming forward from the Old Testament. Now, oftentimes, the realm of the dead is used in a very negative way in terms of it's the place where fools are led to in their own folly. But still it has the same idea that they're cut off from the land of the living. That's Psalm 107 and verse number 18. Now, the fact that he uses not just this reference to Hades or hell or the grave or the realm of the dead, but he also refers to the gates, gives it much more this sense of realm of the dead, place of the dead, than it does just necessarily what we might think of as grave. But essentially, it is a reference to death. Now, more specifically, in this very context in which Jesus is speaking, the gates of Sheol is where God's anointed will go because he's going to suffer innocently and he's going to be executed at the hands of his enemies, only to later be brought up from the gates of Sheol and causing God to be praised in the gates of Jerusalem. And that is part of the messianic prophecy in Psalm chapter 9, verses 13 to 14. And then we read further in Psalm 16 and verse 10, that though the Messiah will go to Sheol, he will not be left there. He will not end there. And the work of his life will certainly not be ended. Psalm 16 and verse number 10. So, what is it that Jesus is revealing to his disciples? Jesus is revealing that his purpose and his work is not going to be interrupted or thwarted or put to a stop because of his death. He's going to go to the gates of hell. He's going to go to the gates of Hades, the gates of Sheol, the various references. He's going to go there, but that's not the end. That doesn't mean that his kingdom then never comes, like it would mean for mortal men. And actually, when you read all of this context, again, you have these references to death in every one of these instances. Jesus, right after this, is going to give the first and the clearest prophecy of his death and his resurrection in the gospel. And we proceed, verse 19, "And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Jesus still speaking to Peter and the other apostles. Now, keys obviously refers immediately to authority, and here it refers immediately to the authority and the office of the apostles. And here they are receiving, again, revelation, new revelation, something they have never heard or understood prior to this time. They are to bind what is or what has been bound, and they are to loose what is or what has been loosed. And that's very legal language, the binding and the loosing. Well, the apostles, as we have seen, as we've come through in Matthew's gospel, particularly in Matthew 13, they are discipled scribes of the kingdom. And they are given keys to open up the householder's stores and to bring out both new and old. And this they did by showing how that Jesus fulfilled the Old Testament prophecies, he will fulfill the remaining prophecies, and giving the new revelation through Christ in the law of Christ and in the completion of the revelation of the New Testament that completes the revelation begun in the Old. Verse number 20. "Then charged he his disciples that they should tell no man that he was Jesus the Christ." Now, this charge, as strange as it may seem, does become clearer in the next beginning of the next chapter. But essentially, Jesus is here giving them new revelation, and they were not yet to reveal it to anyone else. And one of the reasons why is because they didn't yet really have everything that they needed to know. And then we see the second instance where Jesus gives this very clear, very specific prophecy of his coming death, beginning in verse 21. From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised again the third day. Now, Matthew says, from that time forth, and he's repeating this phrase from chapter 4 and verse 17, which reads, from that time Jesus began to preach and to say, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So we see there is certainly a shift in focus, and there's essentially a withdrawal of the offer of the kingdom. Israel has rejected the king and the kingdom. And this preaching of the gospel or the kingdom being near at hand and all of that message that we saw in the beginning, now that's going to shift. Now we're seeing Jesus much more privately. He's going to speak to his disciples about his coming death and resurrection. And publicly, he's going to be very scathing as he addresses Pharisees and Sadducees and such going forward. And there really is going to be a sort of a de-emphasizing of any sort of public miracles and signs, though there are still some to come. And he says to his disciples here, he tells them that he must go. And the use of that language there means that it is compulsion. It's necessity. It's obligation. He has to go to Jerusalem. And notice he says he's going to Jerusalem to the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes. These are the leaders of Israel. In other words, this rejection of Jesus will be official. It'll be by the nation. And he says that he will be killed. That means that he will be slain. He will be put to death. He's referring to execution. And he will be raised again the third day, his resurrection, which he spoke somewhat of his resurrection back in Matthew chapter 12 and verse number 40, that sign of the prophet Jonah. But here he gives the first clear revelation and prophecy of his coming suffering and death and resurrection. Verse 22, then Peter took him and began to rebuke him, saying, be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. So Peter is reacting here to hearing this for the first time. It's the first time Peter has heard these words. He did not have this expectation. And he couldn't really understand it. He couldn't really conceive of it. Verse 23, but he turned and said unto Peter, get thee behind me, Satan, thou art an offense unto me, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. So Jesus rebukes him. And essentially, Peter here in this instance, he was not binding what was already bound. He wasn't loosing what was already loosed. In other words, he's actually opposing the purpose of God, which means he's aligning himself with the work of Satan in this instance. And then we get the next exchange as this continues, beginning in verse 24, where Jesus speaks of coming in judgment and glory. Then said Jesus unto his disciples, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Now it might seem like sort of a change of subject, but it's made very clear because Jesus is going to talk about his coming again. It's made very clear he's still essentially talking about the same things. Peter and the apostles believed that Jesus was the Messiah. They believed he was the Son of God. And Peter and the apostles had thoughts of glory and the kingdom. And soon after, we're going to have references to them, and they're arguing amongst themselves about which one of them is the greatest, who's going to have the greatest position in the kingdom, who's going to have the greatest reward, who's going to have the most authority, and all that sort of thing. They had in their minds thoughts of glory and the coming kingdom. And Peter couldn't conceive of Jesus suffering and dying. He couldn't in his mind grasp how that could fit with the prophesied purpose in the Old Testament. Well, not only will Jesus suffer, but his apostles and all his disciples will suffer in one way or another. And so Jesus says, if any will come after me, if any will be my disciple, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And taking up the cross means laying down your life. In other words, you have forfeited, you have surrendered your life. Whatever that's going to mean. It may mean a martyr's death. It may not. It may mean various tortures and persecutions and sufferings. It may mean something else as far as things that you're going to encounter. But what taking up your cross means is that you are committed to die in faith, however that is going to come in God's purpose. Now, this way of following Jesus is explained more in the verse that follow, verse 25. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. So, Jesus is showing this choice between losing and saving life. In other words, to try to avoid suffering and to try to avoid even death for Christ's sake is to try to save your life. That's what Jesus is talking about. And it ultimately means losing it. It means that you're making a choice over Jesus Christ. And anyone that chooses this present life over Jesus Christ, it's not worthy of him, he says in some places, is not a true believer in him. Verse 26, for what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Well, Jesus makes it clear that the soul is what is at stake. And the point again is suffering. The suffering ahead for Christ, the suffering in this age for his disciples. And he asked that question, what gain have you made? If you've gained the whole world by denying Christ and choosing the world over him to save your own skin, what gain have you made? Because he says, then you've lost your own soul, and in fact, you are not saved. You are not a follower of Jesus Christ. And then Jesus comes to the conclusion of this, and he's continuing. You see the four there. He's continuing explaining verse 27. For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father and with his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his works. Suffering and even death is not a roadblock to God's purpose. It is in God's purpose. If you think back again to Daniel, this reference to the Son of Man, this Son of Man is going to receive this kingdom, but also you read in Daniel 9:26, the Messiah must be cut off. And after he's cut off, later, there will be tribulation. Verse 27 in chapter 9. But then when he comes back, which takes us back to Daniel chapter 7, then will come judgment and his reign in his kingdom. So what is the message? Well, before glory is suffering, but his future coming in glory puts that present choice in perspective because he says, essentially, he's coming to judge. His reward is with him. Punishment to unbelievers and reward to believers. The reward of entering into his kingdom on earth. Verse 28, verily I say unto you, there be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Again, Jesus giving revelation to his apostles. And so he has foretold his suffering. He has foretold the suffering of his apostles. But he's also revealing here that of these 12 men that are standing before him, some of them, he says, will not die before they see him in his glory. And what we learn as we proceed into the next chapter, that some of them is actually three of them, and they will see this in just a brief glimpse on the mountain 6 days after Jesus spoke these words. But that gets us into the next chapter. So again, we look at this passage. Death is thematic. And the message here comes out again and again, what death will not prevent. Death will not prevent Jesus from accomplishing all of the Father's purpose. Peter, let that thought die. Death is not going to prevent Jesus. In fact, it's part of the purpose. He said, I must go to Jerusalem to suffer and be killed. Death will not prevent some of the apostles from physically seeing Jesus in his kingdom glory. Most of them are not going to see that. And most of Jesus' believers and disciples, followers in this age, are not going to see that. But some will see it. They're going to get just a little glimpse of it. They're going to see it, some. But death is a part of this age, right along with suffering. And Jesus makes it clear that if you're trying to avoid that, by denying Christ, you lose your own soul. That's eternal condemnation. Now, as Jesus continues to give new revelation, he's also showing that this is consistent. It's a continuation of the old. Scripture has been fulfilled and will be fulfilled. And Jesus, just as he's promising here, he will come again. And when he comes in power. He comes in glory, and he comes with judgment and reward in his hands.